Good afternoon. I'm Jason Parrott, and this is Emphasis. Joining us this afternoon is Keokuk Police Chief Tom Crew. Chief, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
This afternoon, we wanted to have you on because this is your last official week on the job here with the force. You're retiring after 25 years in law enforcement. Starting off, what is it like to be to this point where when you walk out of that office, you're not going to be coming back?
It's kind of a bittersweet situation. When you've had a career that you truly enjoyed, you know, it's never been a chore to come to work. My wife says it's a fault of mine that I find every excuse to come to work. You know, when a lot of people find reasons not to, I tend to love to come to work still. And so it's going to be tough for me. It's going to be I'm going to go through a transition phase here, you know, where I'm used to being around law enforcement officers and everything that involves, and then I'm just going to be a regular citizen, you know, after this. And it'll be an adjustment for myself.
Why was this the right time for you to step away?
This is a good time with our council. The police department has a good support, I feel, from the council right now. And they're not looking to downsize us, and they haven't. They've agreed to replace the officers, and we had Officer Simmons retire last month. We're just in the process of finishing out and offering a job to an individual to replace him. I'll be leaving. I just found out I have another officer that's been with us not all that long, but is leaving to go back to be a law enforcement officer in their hometown area. And so there's three openings, you know, for our department, and there's not a lot of major fires burning like there were when I first took over as the chief of police. And I kind of said in my letter, it was being the chief of police was challenging and rewarding, you know, and at the very beginning, there were a lot of challenges associated with it. But I didn't want to leave any burning fires or battles to fight for the next person that comes on board, and hopefully that make it as smooth a transition for them, and so they can focus on the direction of the department and some changes that they feel that younger thoughts for the department and for the betterment of the officers themselves. I thought it was just as good a time as any.
How did you decide that you wanted to get into law enforcement? I mean, when did you decide growing up, I guess you could say, that was going to be your career?
Growing up, you would have never, the people that where I come from, my hometown, would have never said that this would be an occupation that I would have chosen and excelled in. So it really wasn't something I decided. I worked at the YMCA, and I worked around police officers. Rick Marlin was a police officer who later became a fireman. And we got along good. I remember one day Chief Francis Marlin, you know, said, "Hey, if you take the test, I'll hire you." And I took the test, and I was hired, and it suited my personality, and I loved everything that law enforcement had to offer.
When you started off, did you ever see yourself moving up the administrative chain, continually going to the ranks up to becoming the chief? I mean, was that something that you saw when you were young?
I didn't start off, and some do. Some of the younger officers want the chief's job right away, but I never thought of it that way initially. But as I watched Chief Marlin retire and Major Beard, and those were all people that I'd looked up to and were my bosses, you know, and kind of mentored me on the way through, that I thought, well, maybe when the time comes, I can throw my hat in the ring and see what happens. And sometimes they say, be careful what you ask for, because I got it, you know, and in that process. But it was something that I wanted to do in hopes that I could lend my thoughts that I thought how things might be done or could be run a little bit different, you know, when I was an officer that wasn't in the command structure. And I took some of my ideas and brought them forward, and I hoped that it would have been for the betterment of the department, and did the best I could, you know, with those ideas. But as far as thinking right off the bat that I wanted to be chief of police, no, that didn't cross my mind for a lot of years till I got a lot older. I really enjoyed my career in narcotics enforcement, and I kind of went out of there kicking and screaming, to be honest with you.
How has law enforcement changed since you started with the department to today?
Technology is huge, I'll be honest with you. When we first came on, we didn't even have pagers, you know, when we first came on for communication, and our radios were pretty basic, you know, and we didn't have computers. We didn't, you know, tell my grandkids this, and they go, gosh, you know, you're a dinosaur, you know, if you didn't have those kind of things. But technology is a big thing that has changed. The youth today, a lot of them have less respect for authority than they used to have when I first came on. The presence of a law enforcement officer, in a lot of cases in the 80s and early 90s, just your mere presence calmed the situation down. But now there's a lot of them have little or no respect for anybody within authority, and it's been challenging that aspect for a lot of us. But the biggest thing is the technology has changed tremendously. You know, tasers have come on board, which have changed how we do things. Computers and the information we get it's instant information now, availability to us, computers in our cars, computers, our phones are computers, you know, anymore. The city got us these iPads, you know, that we're using, and I'm amazed. I mean, this is nothing more. It's a computer, and they're very helpful tools, and the information that, you know, we're able to identify people that are in our system through our Shield Ward programs that we've developed within the Sheriff's Department and the Fort Madison Police Department and Keokuk. We all have the same programming. We didn't used to have that before. It was all independent. Everybody had their own little way of doing things. Now interoperability has been a huge kind of buzzword, you know, in law enforcement and emergency services, period. And funding, grants, and everything are funneled towards those agencies and those operations that try to make their programs and their departments more communication directed, I guess you should say. And it's been a process. And seeing the dispatch centers, you know, leave, you know, and consolidate has been bittersweet, you know, too. And in the process, it was going to come anyway. And when we decided to do that, that was a big change, you know, in law enforcement, because
no problem.
Yeah, I'm going to shut that thing. So overall, still, just technology has changed the way we do things in law enforcement. It's been a struggle for some of us older guys, you know, throughout the years to be able to become computer literate, you know. And I'll be honest with you, I resisted it for a long time, and that I didn't want to use it, you know. And but then it became a phase that you had to. All of our information goes to Des Moines. It goes to the reporting system. It goes to our uniform crime reportings, all done via computers, you know, and the internet process. And so our grant reporting and writing and everything else is submitted via the internet and things. So you just had to step on board, and you had to get on that train. You had to write it, and you had to learn it, you know. But it's even our older officers will admit it's been good for law enforcement.
Thinking back, what is that case that you'll always refer to if someone came up to you and said, hey, biggest case you ever worked, the best bust, I guess you'd say, you ever had? What's that case for you that really stands out?
Well, it would be the Bergstrom methamphetamine case, where unfortunately it's a tragic case that I was noted for, that have the youngest overdose and death of a juvenile ingesting homemade methamphetamine case, and it reached out and touched a whole bunch of people. But I had children that same age, you know, and it could have happened to anybody, you know, in the situation. But a 14-year-old girl here in Lee County ingested methamphetamine through their parents and step-parents making methamphetamine. And it ended up being a federal case, and it wrapped up a whole bunch of people associated with it. And it was a tough case to investigate. We spent a lot of time on it. We were successful in the prosecution of those individuals, but it's kind of always stuck with me, you know, and I always say it wasn't labeled the Jessica Smith case, but in my mind, that's what we, you know, we call the Jessica Smith case. And there were one of our agents, Roger Vernoy with DEA, was the federal case investigator, you know, with that case. And I can remember him telling me he was in Washington, D.C. for a training, you know, session up there, and they got to talking. His instructors were talking about this case, and he raised his hand and said, that was my case, you know. And it came out of the Lee County Narcotics Task Force, and we presented it to the federal level, and he ended up giving the presentation on it. But, you know, they wanted to know clear to D.C. how can that happen in the Midwest where a 14-year-old girl dies from or even gets a hold of methamphetamine, uses it. But it was a case that's touched a lot of us, you know, and it does come from the forefront when people ask me, what is the case? And it's just the tragedy associated with it had a big impact on me.
You mentioned the task force. You spent a number of years as a part of the task force also. What have you seen from the task force? What does that do for Lee County?
Oh, Lee County Narcotics Task Force is a kind of a household name here in Lee County and in the tri-state area. And without those guys out there in the task force combating, you know, the illicit sales of narcotics in our area, it'd be a Wild West show around here. It's never ending. You know, some people say legalize it, you know, and tax it and get revenue from it, you know, and let those use it, you know, take their road to destruction or whatever. But the road to destruction will be the innocent people that are associated with it. And the children that are involved in this that we find in these homes and that have lived in the homes where methamphetamine is being cooked, we're getting those kids help, you know, in the process by doing that, by investigating these cases. And these guys they work countless hours, you know, as we did, you know. And it's, things have changed tremendously in that business too. I mean, Buck Jones, Sheriff Jones, who's retired, myself and Lee Barnes were the first investigators that I worked with. Captain Dobson and Buck Jones another gentleman from Fort Madison were kind of started the task force originally. And we were on the infant stage of this methamphetamine epidemic that we see today on the manufacture. And we've seen the technology change in that, how we do things. OSHA now, you know, they're involved with it. We're dealing with hazardous waste disposal. And a lot of us guys that did it earlier on, that some of my other colleagues that with the state and other local agencies have been exposed to hazardous chemicals and things associated with it, because we used to do what we call the waffle test. And that's nothing more than if you find a jar in your garage, you don't know what the heck it is, you undo the lid and you smell it. And if it smells bad, you go, oh, you know, it's got to be solvents or some kind of chemicals or something, and you try to guess what it is. And that's what we used to do. We used to waffle that smell into our nose and go, oh, okay, and then take a big whiff of it. That's unheard of today. We wear fully encapsulated suits and breathing apparatus because it has affected us, a lot of us physically. And some of us that did the earlier stages weren't as fortunate as I am to not suffer some health situations because of it, and that are going to be life-threatening later on as they get older and surely not going to do them any good. But as far as the task force, we've had some issues, you know, as far as funding situations, and it's going down every year. It was only set up originally for us to have seed money and just to get us started and up and going. And we've been fortunate for the last 18 years to get funding from the federal government. And that's unusual because we're one of only one other single county task force. Everybody else are 10 county, 5 county, 6 county task forces that are put together. They take a whole bunch of little monies and have two or three guys work 5 counties. That doesn't work. And we're just inundated with cases here just in Lee County. But we've been labeled a gateway county for narcotics coming from the south up and from the east this direction through. And it's proven true, you know, that we truly police the tri-state area. Some of our people that come in here from for the different states, you know, and we work closely with the other agencies. But Missouri has less enforcement in this area than we do, and so sometimes our cases don't stop at the border. You know, we continue on with the information, work with them, and try to, you know, take care of the ones that are just coming border jumping back and forth in that process. So it's the task force is a vital organization, and it will continue, you know, way after I'm gone. And and it's, we, like I said, we have always rated very high in the competitive grant process and stayed alive because they wanted to consolidate us with other counties. But our caseload's a lot higher than some of those other counties, so we've continued to be funded. So,
law enforcement, obviously a job. You're putting your life on the line every day out there. Was there a time, a situation where you really thought, how am I going to get out of this? I mean, have you had that point?
I really haven't been forced to that point, and we attribute a lot of it. I attribute a lot of that because we were tactically sound in a lot of situations, but, you know, it can go bad like the flip of a light switch, and it just didn't. I was lucky. It didn't with me. I've never had to discharge my firearm in the 25 years that I've been here. I've had it out. I've had it ready. I've had it pointed, you know, at individuals, but things went my way. And that's a very successful career. I always tell my younger guys, if you never use that gun till you retire, that's successful. Because when you do, something went wrong, you know, in a lot of aspects, and or... Gosh darn it. And so we... I'm going to go back to my train of thought here. We train really hard not to get in those situations, and I think it's been a credit to the other officers that we've had, firearms instructors, our defensive tactics instructors, to train our personnel and stuff and to plan ahead, and that's always been something. So what if? What if this happens? What if this happens? And we've been very successful in that process in my endeavors that I've been involved with not to get in that situation. But the potential for, you know, somebody talking nice and thinking mean, you know, could happen to any one of us. And it's this kind of a strange profession we have, but we run to everybody's problems. We don't run away while everybody's running away without a moment's thought. You know, we go do that. But I guess you don't sit back and think a lot of times, boy, that could have been really bad. And there has been some situations, but none really come to the forefront where I really felt this could have been my last day, you know.
Best day on the job, thinking back over 25 years, what day stands out?
Oh, gosh. The best day on the job. One of my most fuzzy feel-good moments, you know, I had was, it was in narcotics enforcement, was I'd received a phone calls from a lady for years, for several months, actually, almost a year, and involving an individual making dealing drugs in their neighborhood, and I knew this person had to be frustrated, but I'd answer the phone and they'd write and give me license plate numbers and blah, 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 and just kept feeding. I'm sure they thought that this was going to be a 30-minute episode on Miami Vice, you know, and that we'd take care of the problem, but we didn't have the right piece of puzzle. Then one day, with the help of that information we compiled, plus some other information, we had the right recipe, you know, for a search warrant, and we put it together, and we took the person down, and we put him away for a long period of time, and I was in a grocery store, and this lady comes up to me, and she says, thank you for taking care of that problem next door to me. And I go, you're the lady. And she goes, what? I go, you're the lady. I never knew her. I never met her, but I had talked to her a million times. And she, you know, she gave me a hug and thanked me, you know, for the efforts, you know, that we put forth in the situation. And I've never forgotten that, you know, how I felt, you know, we made a difference to somebody. We really made a difference, you know, to them and their lives. I felt we did. And they thanked us for it. So it kind of always stuck with me. That's probably one of the, you know, it really, there's not many warm, fuzzy feelings in law enforcement, to be honest with you, because we're dealing with everybody else's tragedy in a situation, you know. But when any one of the situations turns out good, you know, and we bring a kid home safe, or we find the parents of a lost child. You know, those little things, we take it for granted here in this business. It's just our job. This is what we do. But there's or to somebody, you know, I remember a lady one time that that car was speeding into town, and I hit my lights and turned around. It was late at night, and I got in behind them, and they're not stopping for me. And I'm right behind them. And then they turn off of Main Street towards the hospital, and I said, okay, something's wrong here. They're not. And so I followed them, and I said, you know what, they're going to the hospital. So I got in front of them, and I went the direction of the hospital because they weren't going to stop at the stop signs. They had an emergency, and truly they did have an emergency where his wife was in labor, and they had a problem with the baby, and they knew there was something wrong, and they needed to get to the hospital right now. And I just pulled in. They bailed out, rushed right in the emergency room, ran in. I said, there's not even a reason to talk to them. Okay, they're here, legitimate situation. Later on, they wrote a letter to the chief at that time, thanking the officer that had, you know, escorted them to the hospital and that thing, and it saved the life of the child, you know, in the process. And you did, but I didn't know that's what was going on, you know. A lot of our officers have done things over the years that the general public won't get involved in, and I would call them heroes, you know. We don't start out to be heroes. It's just something that happens, you know, in the situation. But a lot of our officers day to day in law enforcement do things that without a moment's thought to save somebody's life and or to make their life, you know, better. And they just do it, and they put themselves in harm's way every day. We don't think about it, but that's just what we do. You know, it's we get paid to do that, but we didn't sign on saying this is what we're going to do. It wasn't any handbook, you know, that said, but our guys, the police officers are just like that, you know, and it does take a toll on some people. And it's how they handle it individually, the stress involved with these different things, the ups and downs in law enforcement, from winking and waving and saying hi to you're involved in a situation where you don't know if you have to fight the individual or whatever it is, you know, that you're dealing with at that given point. But there's no, every day is not the same in this business. And all our guys, we have some really good police officers here in Keokuk, and that really serve, you know, our patch is to serve and protect, and they surely do serve the community, and they do protect their community.
You kind of touched on it, that you guys run toward and deal with others' tragedy. From the contrast of the best day, the hardest day that you've had as a police officer.
The hardest day I had as a police officer would have been when our firefighters were killed. To be honest with you, I was the field supervisor of the task force. I was actually in Iowa City. We'd taken in a young man and into our home, and he had some surgery on his face, and I told the guys I wasn't going to be in that day till after lunch. I had to go get him in Iowa City. He had his jaw wired shut for an operation with his teeth, and I got a phone call from my task force guys, and Dan Fell says, he said, boss, he says, can you sit, are you sitting down? I knew they had a search warrant there and do that day. And I said, are you guys okay? Was my first response. And they said, yeah, we're fine, but can you sit down? I got to tell you something. And what he told me kind of shook me to the core at that time, because I'm used to being in charge or in control of situations, and I wasn't going to be in control of this situation. And, you know, he told me there was a fire, and that, there'd been three firemen are dead, and my wife was part of that crew, and she was a fireman, and they didn't know her if she was one of the three. And boy, that took the wind out of my sails, you know. And I was in Iowa City. I had a long ways to get back home in a hurry, and that's back when we had pagers, didn't have cell phones, and the situation, and the people involved in that were people I knew very well. And my wife was, you know, there, and I got all the way back, and I couldn't tell Adam what was going on, but he knew something was wrong. You know, something seriously was wrong, but if I told him, he might start crying and his jaw wired shut, you know, and that was not going to be good for him. And I got stopped by the state patrol coming home, and I identified myself, told him what was going on, and he reminded me I can't be part of the solution if I become part of the problem, I proceeded on home, and I found out my wife was fine, which is was a relief, but yet it as soon as that relief was then I was overwhelmed with what had happened with the situation. So that would rate the worst day that I had, while I was a police officer. And it was the worst day for our community and for others involved too. So, but that stands out in my mind and as my worst day on the job. So
probably the final thing, what do you want people to think about that see police officers out there, but they don't know what it's like to be a police officer? What do you want them to know about the profession that you've chose for your career?
You make out of your career what you want to, and how you handle people and deal with people either makes you have a successful career or you don't. I've always had a philosophy that you treat everybody like you'd want to be treated if you're in the same situation, and just kind of reflect back and take a deep breath. But law enforcement is very rewarding to those of us that truly look at this as a service profession. And I can't think of a better job I could have had. And it has, I say this, I really didn't have a job, I had a career. And I had a career that I still enjoy. I still enjoy the people that I worked with. I told my one of my kids, they were asking, well, what's it been like? And I kind of alluded to, I got on a big tour bus, and there was a bus driver, and I got on as a probationary police officer. And then the door opened up, and two more people got on, and now that bus is full of federal agents, federal attorneys, colleagues, business people, that I've come in contact, all the people I've come in contact with, and other younger generations of police officers that are riding that bus now. It's just time for me to get off, but it's been a great ride for me in law enforcement. And it could be anybody that thinks they would like to serve their community, and you can't ask for a better career or a better occupation to do it in. And you got to be somewhat risk aggressive, to do this job. And I had a neighbor one time asked me when I was cleaning out my trunk for the task force, had all my tools of the trade. That was our office, our cars. And he goes, "What's that?" And I said, "That's the RAM." I said, "I'm the RAM man. I go through the door first. What's that?" I said, "That's a short shotgun that with a sling that we use and this." And he was just asking everything about it. And I said, "These are the tools, like carpenter's hammer and saws and everything. These are what my tools and the thing." He goes, "Well, let me ask you one question. If there's a bank robbery at State Central Bank today, where do you want to be?" I said, "I want to be in the bank." He goes, "So that's the difference between you and me. I want to be in St. Louis at Six Flags with my kids." And that's kind of the way it is with law enforcement. We want to be where we're needed and where the action's happening, if it involves law enforcement, the type of that activity that we're trained to do. And so he still jokes about that when I see him. But it is true. Most of us, we're somewhat risk aggressive, but it's a very rewarding career. You're not going to get rich, but you'll pay your bills in the process. But whether it's state or local law enforcement, we all do the same. Federal law enforcement's come a long way to being very, more approachable than they used to be. They used to come in and say, "I'm the FBI or I'm the ATF or DEA, and I'm going to take this case over." Well, it starts at our level, and we work together now instead of against each other. And so the working relationship has been great. And I tell my guys, too, that have contacts with those agencies, too, hey, not only are they your colleagues, but if you can in some way, find something in common and become friends with those individuals. And because a friend will do much more for you in this business than a mere acquaintance. And it paid off for me, worked for me, and it's working for some of the other guys, too. Some of my investigators are friends with ATF agents they've worked with and stuff like that. And 10 or 15 years ago, 25 years ago, that wasn't the case. You know, we were the FBI, we are the ATF, we are that. But there, those agencies have gone great strides to develop working relationships with them, you know, and to send officers like myself and Assistant Chief Hinton to the National FBI Academy, you know, for 12 weeks. And that's 2% of law enforcement get an opportunity, an invitation to go to those, you know, to the to that training and to in Quantico and talk to other officers that have done that. It's that's a life-changing event, you know, for you too. And but that's something that they put together knowing that they cannot be successful in their job without including the people that live in that community and know the people, and the cases run so much smoothly through that networking programs that have been set forth.
All right. Well, as I look at my clock, I believe we're out of time. Chief, thank you for the time today and all the time that you've given our listeners over the last few years.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure. It's been a pleasure serving the citizens of Lee County and Keokuk, Iowa. And I've enjoyed the opportunity that the last 7 years have presented to me to be as the Chief of Police of Keokuk.
That was Keokuk Police Chief Tom Crew, who is retiring after 25 years in law enforcement. For Tri-States Public Radio News, I'm Jason Parrott.